All right, so if you have a Bible, let me invite you to turn to 1 Samuel 17, all right? So last week, we were introduced to arguably the most famous man in all of ancient history, David, the son of Jesse from the tribe of Judah, from the town of Bethlehem. And this week, we come to arguably the most famous story in all of ancient history, the account of David and Goliath. But let's read it, or at least most of it. We're going to start with verse 1. Of 1 Samuel 17, and read through verse 50. And even then, I'm going to skip a few verses here and there to sort of keep us moving. But if you have a Bible open in front of you, that would allow you to sort of follow along and then compare as we kind of go through the sermon. If you don't have a Bible, you want to follow along with one that's in the chair racks, then 1 Samuel 17 is on page 305. And because this is so long, let's stay seated while I read it so that you can concentrate better on the text. 1 Samuel 17, starting at verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Succah and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley in between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield-bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistines came forward and took his stand morning and evening. All right, now skip to verse 24. David sent by his father to bring food to his brothers on the front line, get an update, and then when David is there, Goliath comes out again. Verse 24. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" All right, verse 32. David continues, his continued questions end up with him in front of King Saul now. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him," that is Goliath. "Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." Verse 36. "Your servant has struck down both lions and bears," David said, "and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "God and the Lord be with you." Now skip to verse 40. All right, fighting the conventional way is not going to work for David. Armor, swords, all that kind of stuff. So verse 40, what David did, it says, is he took his staff in his hand and he chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with a shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with the sword and the spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. This is the word of the Lord. All right, point number one, back of the bulletin, right? This is what it says, understand the story. Now, like I said, this is arguably the most famous story in all of ancient history, the account of David and Goliath. Everyone, right? Religious scholars of all backgrounds, secular scholars, everyone places this story at the center of Jewish identity, right? It's in every children's Bible, right? It's an archetype, even for those who don't view it as historical, it's an archetype for one of the most foundational plot lines in all of literature, right? The David and Goliath story. Everyone knows this story. Now, just quickly, how does it go? Let's just summarize what we just read. Right, how would you summarize it? Ready? Go. Right? First, King Saul, Israel's king, he's been a failure. He's on his way out. You want to know why? Go back to chapter 15. And this unknown kid named David has been secretly anointed to eventually become the new king. You want to find out how he was anointed? Go back to chapter 16. Now, you have the Philistines and you have the Israelites, and they're facing off in the Valley of Elah. And it's a very key strategic piece of real estate between these two nations. And what the Philistines do is they send Goliath, a huge giant of a warrior, right? Somewhere between almost 7 feet and 9.5 feet tall, depending on which Hebrew manuscript you favor. But one way or another, this guy's a giant. He's scary big, right? And Goliath challenges an Israelite, any Israelite, to a winner-take-all battle. And the Israelites are all afraid, everyone except David, who accepts the challenge and, despite the apparent mismatch, kills Goliath, Israel wins, and everyone celebrates. Okay? That's the story. And we all know it, or we think we know it. Right? Let's step back for a second. I don't know if I've ever shared this with anyone ever before, but when I was in college, what I would do before a big exam, you know, a midterm or a final exam or something, what I would do is I would go into my room all by myself, and I would pull out my CD of Calm Wilkinson, a great Irish tenor, and I would put in that song from The Man of La Mancha, Dream the Impossible Dream, right? And I would turn it up really loud, and I'd listen to Calm Wilkinson belt out the quest of the character Don Quixote, right? To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, right? To reach the unreachable star, right? And I'd use that to get, you know, to get psyched up for the exam. Right? The exam was the foe. I was the dreamer, ready to fight, to reach, to conquer. It's corny, I know. But that was my psych-up song. Now, if we're perfectly honest, the story of David and Goliath is most often used as sort of like a Judeo-Christian psych-up song. Right? And after all, I mean, it's the classic story of the underdog. We love the underdog story. Right? Yesterday was the 40th anniversary, wasn't it, of the Miracle on Ice? Remember when a bunch of college amateur hockey players defeated the greatest team in the world in the 1980 Winter Olympics, the Soviet Union? Right? Everybody loves an underdog. And David has become the classic example of the metaphor of the underdog. It gives you goosebumps, right? But here's the problem, right? Here's the problem. The version of the story that's most often told, the version of David and Goliath that we most often kind of have in our heads, tells us that if we have enough faith, then we can be like David, right? We can defeat our giants no matter how big they are. Just believe, right? And while that might work for some things, right, like hockey games and stuff, right, our greatest enemies as human beings, our greatest enemies, they're significantly bigger than a big guy with a spear, right? They're matters of the heart, selfishness, greed, arrogance, pride. They're matters of behavior that we're powerless to overcome ourselves, addiction. Matters of the world and fallenness, like disease, right? Ultimately, our greatest enemy, death itself, right? You can't kill that stuff with a sling and a stone. And if we think that we can conquer those things by just sort of getting psyched up, then we're ultimately going to be disappointed, very, very disappointed. Now, don't get me wrong, right? There is a powerful metaphor in the story of David and Goliath. But to grasp the power of that metaphor, we need to apply the story rightly. Right? David and Goliath should give you goosebumps, but we need to make sure that it's for the right reason. So let's make three applications that I think would be helpful. Those are the three applications listed on the back of the bulletin. First application, know your God. Now, in this face-off that occurs between David and Goliath here, what you have fundamentally is a confrontation between competing gods, right? And the foundational question is, what God do you trust in to save you from your worst enemy? When you go into battle against your biggest enemy, what God are you going to trust in? Right? For example, start with Goliath, right? He comes to the battle with all the latest, coolest battlefield technology, right? The best that money can buy, right? Very few people had the resources to fight with armor, right? And Goliath had a full coat of armor for his torso. He had additional armor to protect his legs. Right? He's got a huge shield that's so big it requires a separate man just to carry it for him. And he's got the latest spear with an iron tip. We're just at the edge, just at the beginning of the Iron Age here, right? Goliath is a high-tech early adapter. Right? Now, this isn't to say that a soldier shouldn't be properly equipped with the best kind of protection and equipment that his country and resources can provide. But see, in Goliath's case, it's very clear that all of these things that seem to him to provide an advantage, that's what he's trusting in. I mean, it says in verse 43 that Goliath cursed David by his gods, most likely Dagon and Ashtoreth, right? But for all practical purposes, he's not trusting in his national deities. He's trusting in himself. And he's full of confidence, right? I mean, he talks some serious trash to David. Did you see that? Right? Come out here so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, right? But here's the problem with that. Here's the problem. If it were simple enough to say that overcoming your biggest enemy is possible just by having the most faith, the highest self-esteem, the right attitude, to sort of imagine yourself as the victor, to visualize your victory, right? Well, if that's the case, if that's all that's necessary, Goliath should never have lost, right? Goliath had loads of confidence, right? He had been taunting the Israelites for 40 days. He considered himself unbeatable, and probably with good reason. He was bigger, he was stronger, he was better equipped than any man on the field. But the problem was, he had placed his confidence in the wrong God. It's like the song from Sound of Music. I'm kind of into musicals today, right? It's near the beginning of Sound of Music. It's not one of the more famous songs where Maria is a little bit nervous about going and being the governess for this family. And she sings this psych-up song to herself, right? With each step I turn, I am more certain everything will turn out fine. I have confidence that all the world can be mine. They'll have to agree. I have confidence in me. And then the song ends. All I trust becomes my own. I have confidence in confidence alone. Which, I mean, that's terrible. I mean, that's awful. Right? And I love the Sound of Music. I mean, I cry at Edelweiss every time. Right? But this is supposed to be a psych-up song? Right? I have confidence in confidence alone. What's that even mean? Right? And even though she's not talking trash like Goliath, it's the same basic principle. In facing my enemy or in facing my fear, I trust in me. And the very problem with that, of course, is you have to be very careful about the God you trust. Right? Because confidence in yourself, I mean, it might psych yourself up, but it's not going to kill the giant when the giant is, in fact, actually bigger than you. Right? See, there's not an inherent advantage in being the underdog. That's why they call him the underdog. Because there's no inherent advantage there. And even the underdog can place their confidence in the wrong God, right? The best psych-up song in Les Miserables, do you hear the people sing? Right? It's an awesome psych-up song. You know, all these revolutionary students from colonial France, and they're all singing about how they're going to defeat the power of the French army, and they're going to rise up, and they're going to... What's the problem? They're wrong. They get squashed like a grape. Virtually all of them die. Right? This is the point. If you're going to fight a big enemy, you should really question who you're trusting first. And this is where David gets it exactly right. From the very beginning, David is primarily concerned with the honor of the name of the Lord. Right? When he first gets to the front line and he hears Goliath taunting, right? All the Israelites say, he's defying Israel. But in verse 26, David says it differently. He says, no, he's defying the armies of the living God. And then David is brought before King Saul, verse 36, and he says the same thing to Saul. Goliath is going to go down because he's defying the armies of the living God. Now finally, this is the first person to bring theology into the discussion. Right? The very first words of David recorded in the Bible, the very first speeches that he gives bring God into the conversation where God, up to this point, had been absent. Right? Now, this is not a simplistic, you know, just have faith in God and everything will be fine kind of answer, right? That's not what David is saying. But what he is doing is he is returning to the absolute right starting point. He's saying, guys, this Goliath dude is big and tall, but am I right or wrong that on our side is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? You know, the God of Moses, the one who parted the Red Sea, the one who defeated the armies of Pharaoh. Am I wrong, or is that the one who's on our side? And you put it like that, it sounds a little bit silly. In fact, it's interesting. The very popular best-selling author, Malcolm Gladwell, in an interview about his 2013 book that he titled David and Goliath, he says that it had always struck him very, very odd that Christians would view David as an underdog when it says in 1 Samuel 16 that he was filled with the Spirit of the Lord. Right? In actuality, if you do have the right God, David's the favorite. Right? When you view it like that, Goliath is the underdog. Now, of course, you have to see the situation not as man sees the situation, but as God sees the situation. But actually, we should all be doing that. You remember the key verse from 1 Samuel 16 that we looked at last week? Right? Gladwell actually puts 1 Samuel 16:7, right, all by itself on the page before the introduction to the book. The Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." And maybe Samuel didn't tell everyone then what exactly the Lord had said to him, but he said it to us, right? We can read it. We read it last week. So we, above all people, should not be surprised that David does not go into battle here actually as the underdog. Not because he knows himself, not because he has confidence in himself, but because he knows God. Right? That's what David explains to Goliath when they meet in the valley. He explains very clearly the difference between the two of them. He says, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, with a javelin. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel." Right? And he says, "The Lord is going to deliver you into my hand." Why? Why is God going to do this? Well, David tells him that too. "So that all Israel may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not save with a sword and the spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into my hand, into our hand." In other words, what David is saying to Goliath no less, right? God is going to defend his name, right? He wants people, all people, even Philistines, he wants everyone, all people, to have a right understanding of who he is. That's the first application. When you face your greatest enemy, you need to know your God. Second application, embrace your weakness. Now, I referenced Malcolm Gladwell. If you at all have an interest in the way things work in the world and how conventional wisdom often deserves to be questioned, I would highly recommend to you the work of Malcolm Gladwell. And a great place to start is this 2013 book that he wrote, David and Goliath. Full title is David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Now, it's not an explicitly Christian book. It's sociology. It's cultural anthropology. And you might not agree with everything, but it will make you think. And what I love about it is that with a title like that, right, you might expect, it might be very easy to simply think of the book as a series of stories about how underdogs overcome and win despite their weakness. But that would be a complete misunderstanding of the thesis. Gladwell's thesis is not that when victory comes to the underdog, it comes despite his weakness. The thesis is that when victory comes to the underdog, it comes because of his weakness. In other words, victory comes when a weakness turns out to be, in a way that's not apparent to the others, or perhaps even intended, when that weakness actually, even ironically, becomes someone's strength. And that's what's true of David. Right? David is not uniquely qualified to fight Goliath despite his experience and size. David is uniquely qualified to fight Goliath because of his experience and size. Because, see, both his experience and his size make him approach Goliath in a way, the only way, that Goliath can be beaten. Now think about this. The concept of representative close quarters combat was just the way that things were done. And fighting that way, if you're going to fight that way, anyone who's 7, 8, 9 feet tall, whatever, right, anyone that big with a 125 pounds of armor and a 15-pound spear, they're going to win against a small boy, right? That's not insulting to David. That's the reality. But because David is a boy and he's a shepherd, he's not even tempted to play soldier with this guy. Right? He's had this experience before. That's what he tells Saul. He's fought lions and bears. Right? You don't get in a wrestling match one-on-one with a lion. You have to fight differently. Davis's weakness was his advantage. God used the apparent weakness to David's advantage because it forced him to fight differently. Right? And actually, the fact that he was a shepherd also meant that he already had a fairly low reputation in the eyes of others. Right? He didn't have any face to save. People already thought poorly of him. Right? He was used to that. Right? He was used to what others think. He was used to being made fun of. He was used to the taunts, all the derision of his brothers over the years. Right? All those things inoculated himself against the taunts of Goliath. Right? His weakness, being picked on, was now his advantage. Now, one more observation, and there's even more that we could note, but just one more observation. God has David fight with slings and stones. Now, in comparison, this is a very low-tech weapon, right? In comparison, it doesn't require any kind of metals, doesn't require a blacksmith, right? It's just a strip of leather wrapped around a stone, swung very quickly, and then one end of the leather strap is released and the stone flies out, right? That's how it happened, right? But here's the thing. We tend to think of, like, you know, a slingshot like Dennis the Menace or Opie from the Andy Griffith Show or whatever, just like some, you know, little kid kind of running around shooting stones at a squirrel, right? The ancient slinger was very different. Eitan Hirsch is a ballistics expert with the Israeli Defense Forces, and he did a series of calculations that demonstrated that an average-sized stone hurled by an expert slinger at a distance of 35 meters, so that's actually over 100 yards, but at that distance, a stone slung by an expert slinger would have an impact of about 34 meters per second. That's about 80 miles per hour. If you're closer than that, it goes up to like 100, 150 miles per hour. Now, that's equivalent, he says, to the stopping power of a fair-sized modern handgun. Another historian, Robert Dornwen, puts it a little bit more bluntly. He said, Goliath from this perspective, had as much chance against David as any Bronze Age warrior with a sword would have had against an opponent with a 45 caliber pistol. Right? The apparent weakness, low-tech weaponry, is what God uses to give David the advantage. Now, I told you about Gladwell's book. It's a very interesting study and all that. But what's most interesting to me are actually Gladwell's comments that he made to a Washington Post reporter, Sarah Bailey, in a 2013 interview shortly after the book was released. Now, Sarah Bailey, she notes to Gladwell that this seems to be the most religious book you've ever written. And they talk about Gladwell's theological upbringing in an evangelical Mennonite home. And he talks about how this book has actually brought him back into a more Christian understanding of the world. And she asks him then how this principle of actual strength from apparent weakness, how that's expressed in Christianity. She said, David and Goliath is famous, but what about Jesus? Where would he fit into your narrative? And Gladwell says, he actually fits perfectly. He said, here is one of the most revolutionary figures in history, and he comes from the humblest of beginnings. He never had an elective office. He never had an army at his disposal. He never got rich. He had nothing that we would associate with power and advantage. Yet what does he accomplish? An unfathomable amount. He's almost the perfect illustration of this idea that you have to look in the heart to know what someone's capable of. Right? Now, you might question sort of some of the theological precision about what he's saying, but Gladwell's admiration of Jesus is obvious, and his basic point is right on, right? The apparent weakness of God becoming a Jewish man in the first century who would die a shameful death on a Roman cross is in fact the source of what has changed the world in the course of human history. Right? Jesus is the ultimate example of victory not coming despite apparent weakness, but coming through weakness, which is why it's vital for us to get the last application correct. Right? First application, know your God. Second application, embrace weakness. Final application, trust the true champion. I don't know if you caught it when we read it in verse 4, right? There came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath. And this is a very specific word that's used here, right? Champion. It doesn't just mean the best. Like in 1980 when the Phillies won the World Series, it said on the front of the Philadelphia Inquirer, champions, right? Which just meant we're the best, right? This is a very precise term here. The Hebrew word literally means a man between the two. Right? Meaning a man who stepped out between the two battle lines to do battle on behalf of his army. And this, like we said a minute ago, this was a fairly common way that ancient armies and nations would decide what would otherwise be like just a drawn-out slaughter. Very economical. Only one person dies. And each side would select a champion, a representative whose victory or defeat would then be imputed to the entire nation that champion represented. All right, so if your champion won, you would win, and your nation would enslave the other nation, right? The victory of the champion would be imputed to everyone. Now, if your champion lost, then you would lose, and you would become slaves, right? The defeat of your champion would be imputed to you, right? So here's the scene. You've got Goliath, and he's the champion. He's the champion for the Philistines, and he's mocking the Israelites because they couldn't find anyone to be their champion. Now, who should it have been? Who should have been the champion to step out from everyone's perspective? Saul, right? Right? Remember, he's the guy, which is just back in chapter 9. He's a head taller than everyone else. He's the king. But see, by this point, the Spirit of God has left him, and he's cowering in fear, hiding among the baggage again. So he's not going to be the champion, and neither, it seems, is anyone else going to be the champion, right? No one is willing to raise their hands and go out and be the guy to fight Goliath. Now, here's where we need to pause for a second, because there is a powerful analogy to be drawn from this story. There is a metaphor for me and for you here that should give you goosebumps, right? There is a very real sense in which we should envision ourselves in this narrative. But the way that the story is traditionally told, which character are you in the story, right? Who do you want to be? David, right? That's usually the way the story is told, right? He becomes the champion even though he's weak. And so we think, yeah, that's who I want to be, right? I want to be David. So that's the way we tell the story. Right? Goliath is the great enemy of God, right? Who needs to be defeated. That's true. And you, me, you, we're David, and so we should be like David, right? Have faith like David. Slay the giant like David. Be like David. Have faith like David. Now, there's a sense, of course, in which we can learn from potential lessons from David as an example. But just so we're clear here, in the context of the overall flow of the entire biblical narrative and the context of the Bible's story about the battle against our great enemy of God, right? In that big story, me, you, you're not David. I'm not David. We're the Israelites, right? We're the ones who forget about the true identity of the Lord, right? We're the ones who cower in fear when the world waves its shiny modern spear at us, right? We aren't David. We need a David. Actually, we need the one to whom David points. And David, in the Bible's big narrative, sorry to disappoint you, David's not pointing to you. He's pointing to Jesus. Jesus is the true champion. He's the one who answers the call to defend the honor of the Lord. He's the one who fights by unconventional means that at first appear to be weakness. He doesn't stretch out his arm to thrust a spear into the side of the enemy like Goliath would. Jesus stretches out his arms and has a spear thrust into him so that the enemy can be defeated. And through his apparent weakness, he wins the victory over our greatest enemy. And actually, I mean, I said I was sorry to disappoint you. I'm not sorry. Right? There is no more crushing thing that I could do to you, no more discouraging thing that I could say than to try to write you a psych-up song from 1 Samuel 17. Right? It would not work. You cannot win victory over Goliath, the great Goliath of our sin, and the great consequence of that, our death. You cannot fight a Goliath like that no matter how much Broadway you listen to. It's not a fight you can win. You need a champion who will fight for you, who will win, and who will then, upon his victory, impute the spoils of that victory to you. One last thing that's not often noted here. Right? Do you see what the victor gets in the story? What was promised to David if he defeats Goliath? It's in verse 25. The king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Do you know what that means? The champion is going to be taken as a son into the king's household. And then, did you get this? Everyone in his family is going to get to live tax-free in the land. Now, this isn't a big deal in Delaware, but this is huge in New Jersey. And this isn't just the champion who benefits from the champion's victory, right? This is everyone who is a member of the champion's family. That's what it says. His father's house is going to be free in Israel. That's what it means. Now think about the implications of this. Jesus Christ, when Jesus Christ died on the cross, he purchased for you an inheritance that is then imputed to you, transferred to you at no cost. Because his victory was won, you become the beneficiary. You are adopted into the king's family. You are made a son and a daughter. You do not buy your land in the kingdom. You don't have to pay it back. You don't have to rent it from him. As a member of Christ's family, and only as a member of Christ's family, those rights are given to you because his victory becomes yours. And so that's why this is good news for me and you. Because yes, yeah, we're the older brother, cowering in fear, rejecting, ridiculing this champion. But the champion goes to fight on our behalf anyway, and he wins. And because he wins, your place in the kingdom is now paid for, and you owe nothing in return. Let's pray. Father, thank you for sending a champion. A champion who would defeat our greatest enemy and has. And thank you for giving us the benefit of it, even though we don't deserve it. Lord, let us be able to, through this example and in this power, fight the enemies in our life, recognizing that you are the Lord. recognizing that you work through the power of apparent weakness, and recognizing that you are the true champion who has gone before us in the person of Jesus Christ. Strengthen us for your service. In his name we pray. Amen.